with a 5V4. And you had a, I believe it was 120 microfarad filter capacitor, dual section. And they eventually dried out and you started getting a lot of hum in the radios. So an awful lot of the radio and television repair that Mel and I did was replacing those 120 microfarad capacitors. I may be confusing the 120 microfarad with the AC electrolytic that's inside of a Cornell Dubler AR-22 rotator. I got a lot of those around. So some of them still operating, believe it or not. AMM, they also use 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor, which you don't want to use the original product. You want to use a motor start capacitor because it's got a lot more life to it. Whereas the original Cornell Dubilier, they dried out just sitting on the shelf. You can buy them brand new from Harrison Radio, and they were already down to half the number of microfarads and had very little torque. There's torque on the rotator. There are an awful lot of guys who used to think that their rotator would freeze up in the wintertime. They didn't realize it was really the capacitor that was not giving it enough turning capability. With the right number of microfarads in the capacitor in the control head, that rotator could almost break ice that was on the antenna jammed in between the mast and the rest of the tower. Almost could break that ice. Occasionally a whole lot of ice forming around the bell housing at the bottom of the rotator would stop it from operating. And you could get around that problem by putting a whole bunch of washers under the four screws that hold the rotator down to the platform on the middle of the tower. That way, you're raising the bell housing another half inch, three quarters of an inch above the platform, and now ice very rarely will bridge that gap, and you solve the ice freeze-up problem. You never even bothered putting a heater up on the top of the tower. Just avoiding the ice in the first place is a much easier approach. I used to have some pictures when I first moved into my current house of what ice looked like when we had an ice storm, and it would coat up all of the antennas. And with the sun rising in the morning, it made some very pretty pictures. Blue sky in the background and shiny ice on all of the elements of the antenna. I used to also enjoy taking pictures, time-lapse photography. You would set the camera up on a tripod, open the lens, leave it open for about 20 minutes, and aim the camera through the tower into the dark sky. And when you develop that picture, you had a whole bunch of streaks of all the stars curved in the background as the Earth rotated, and they're sweeping across your antenna, and they light up the antenna. The antenna sits there as a silhouette, and by way of reasonable film and a reasonable lens and a time-lapse photograph, you recognize right away that all the stars have individual colors, red, green, blue, and whatever, white, gold. Each star has a particular color to it, depending on its temperature. But because the stars are not very bright, and because your eyes lose color sensitivity, your eyes lose color sensitivity when the light is not very bright. That's why you've heard the expression, all cats are gray at night. But the film catches all that real color. And that modern-day charge-coupled device, color cameras would also. So when you take a time-lapse photograph with a tripod-mounted antenna camera looking through your tower, you see these nice streaks of the stars lighting up the tower in silhouette, and you've got some very pretty colors. Anybody have any further comments on this? K2RIW on the TechNet.
52 with a 35 something with the rectifier. 50C was the 50 was the B power output tube, and I think the 35 was the rectifier and a 5 tube radio.
35W4U4.
5U4, 35W4, 535U4, yes. The early, really inexpensive 5-tube radios didn't even have a filament transformer. They ran all the filament as a series string directly off the 115-volt line, 120-volt line. So you had some really strange sounding voltage numbers on the filament for the tube. That's why you have these 35W4 type tubes. And, when it comes to television sets, 6SN7 was the dual triode that was often used for the oscillator and the driver stage for the vertical deflection and sometimes the horizontal deflection of television sets. The horizontal output tube was a pretty big tube, 25 watt plate dissipation, and so deflection tube type transmitters became popular.
G6.
What was that tube again?
horizontal output, the old black and white. But as you said, 6SN7 was the horizontal MV, and the 6BG6, Boy George 6, that was the horizontal output tube, and the 1B3 was the rectifier.
About 6146, that's also used in TVs back in the 50s.
And not as much, but the 1B3, I certainly remember that tube, great big plate cap to it. And that was the rectifier that gave you the 20-25,000 volts that ran the cathode ray tube. Lots and lots of sets had the 1B3 tube for the main rectifier. And the filament voltage for it was also part of the flyback transformer. It needed very high voltage insulation on that filament. So it had to be a floating filament with high voltage capability. I think the 1B3 was a directly heated cathode. In other words, it wasn't indirect. I think the filament itself of that tube was the cathode of the
diode.
Yes, right. So I call it triode, it was a diode. But it was a rectifier. But wasn't that a directly heated filament, if you happen to remember, Mel?
Heated off the, on the flyback transformer, you had two turns right around on the core that heated up. That 1B3 sat in the high voltage, they used to call it the high voltage cage. And the cap on it, that was right off the top of the flyback, and off the filament, which was a piece of high voltage wire wound, like I say, on two turns around the core. And that was the filament. That's how the filament was heated in there. They never used 6146. Not one TV set ever had a 6146, and otherwise I would have grabbed a lot of them. They did have Dumont built one TV set, and what they did, they had an air core high voltage system that was just a big coil, with a big air core, and that used a 807, and it was a self-oscillating system. That was the only one that came, with anything. The rest of them, you went out on service calls in those days from the 40s up to about 50, and you took along a standard set of tubes, like you said, 6SN7s, 5U4s, 6BG6s, 1B3s, all used the same tubes. That was amazing. They all copied one another system, basically, using RCA, original design there, 630 chassis, about 1945, 46. But, I worked on so many from 6. I don't know how many of I cut up, new parts, and built other things with them. Unbelievable, over.
JHR, we did the same thing in the late 50s.
And JHR was there too. Remember the doorknob capacitor that was doing the filament? That was doing the filtering on the 1B3. The 1B3, the cathode, correction, the plate cap went directly to the top of the flyback transformer. The flyback transformer usually was made out of ferrite material, two great big C cores brought together, rectangular. And then from the filament, the two turns in the filament ran the filament, and then from there, the rectified voltage was filtered with a 500 picofarad doorknob capacitor. And that almost never failed. That was a very high reliability part. What do you think, Mel?
I got a box full of them. Yeah, had two screw terminals. You screwed it on. It held off with two 632 screws untapped on each end. And yeah, it was a yellow capacitor. Had a high voltage rating, 500 picofarad. No, micromic. They all said MSF on it. Stick. You're bringing them up too much today. boy, replaced. You imagine, I remember I used to find a lot of times the filaments, winding would break down. That piece of wire would dry out, the insulation on it. And, of course, with arc. So, take it out and make another two-turn thing there and all, fix them up and take the high-voltage cage apart. And, what I found once the high-voltage cage things that you can get in there, sometimes short out things. Like, you get a, once had a mouse got in there. I've had plenty of experience in those directions, Dick, over.
Remember the high-voltage Q-dope you could buy? It was a high-voltage dope. I'm trying to remember, was it called GC Electronics, I think it was? In these yellow labeled square jars with a big cap on the top and a built-in brush on the cap, and I think it was this maroon-colored juice that was high-voltage substance that when you were getting arcing on something, you could paint it with that and let it dry, and it would stop the high-voltage arcing. In some cases, maybe you didn't have to replace that dried-out piece of wire or metal. Go ahead.
GC is right.
Yeah, Roger, that's right. They did have that, and then they had a clay-like material. Remember that too? That you could form around. You could see those guys. And, you know the rubber cap on the side of the picture tube that was connected onto the high voltage onto the side of the picture tube. That cap used to dry up in here, especially if you would weather that in. So they used to take this I don't know, this clay-like stuff that GC put out at the time, and. You pack it on there. They just do all those strange things, you know, rather than replace the high voltage wire with the rubber cap, stick that on. Oh, I can tell you 101 things that they used to see on those TV sets and all kinds of wild ideas over.
Called cap mold. Cap mold. Do you remember removing the safety glass from the front of a TV set? You would wash both sides of the safety glass. You'd wash off the front of the picture tube. Layers and layers and layers of dust would be there, and once it was washed off, boy, were you a hero. As far as the residents of the house are concerned, all of a sudden they had an extremely bright, high contrast picture, and man, were they happy. I bet you've been through that a few times, Bill.
Oh, do I remember that. Let me tell you what happened. This is case and case why. 1948, no? Yeah, 48. RCA came out with a television set, a 16-inch, was the first of them. Used a metal tube, and it was called 16AP4, the picture tube, in fact. And my mother had put away, she was working as a part-time telephone answering person in a store on where we lived, and she was putting away money to save up for a TV, and we bought that, she surprised the house, and she bought that TV in 1948, RCA 16-inch, and that was what it was placed by. That metal tube was a terrific collector of dirt in between the front glass panel and the inner one. And I was 8 years old, and I remember after 6 months, it was guaranteed. I think they gave you a year guarantee. And the picture started, you know, look, like you say, bogged over. They called the service guy who saw the guarantee, and I watched him how he opened the inside there, you know, he unsnapped the clips in the corner. And the front panel is fold down. Take off the knobs, the four knobs in the front, and the panel is closed, you know, down. You wipe it off, and everything like that, and close it up there and all. And that's when I learned. That's the television set that my first TV that I really learned on was that 1948 version. But I used to clean that thing. I remember. You didn't go 6 months without, you know, cleaning that base plate off on that. Because of that metal tube that they had sitting on four insulators in the corners, because that whole bell was high voltage, takeover.
Yeah, sure do.
Hey, Charles, a query.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, just a query. That particular model from 1948, was that by any chance the Dumont 1620? If so, I worked on one of those or two of those.
Yeah, Mel, you said it was 1948. If it was RCA, I'm believing it would be a 630, and I think that was a 10-inch set. I think it was later years when they came out with anything bigger than a 10-inch set. So, let's see. My family bought an RCA 630 in 1947, and it was a 10-inch. And I think it was a number of years later before they came out with a 12 or 14 or 16-inch. Back to you, Mel.
1948 RCA. Still have it. My brother collects antiques. And we have a whole collection of them. We have the original, my mother's original one that was in, oh, it was beautiful, the cabinet. Even after she stopped using it, wouldn't throw it away, of course. The cabinet was so pretty. So he still got the TV set. And I got the original bill of sale, 1940. I got the original instruction book. It's got the original back on it. I got the original cheetah cord. The knobs, everything is original on it. In fact, all the tubes in it are all original well, not original, but they were replaced with RCA. So we have that set. The one you're thinking about before, we have all the RCA TV sets that were made after World War II, starting in 45. The KR, it was called the KRK-5. They didn't use KS. Later on, they started using the KCF numbers, but they started with the KR number. They changed over RCA in 46 from calling them KR series TV sets to KCF series. The KRK became the number of their tuner for some reason. I don't remember the story of why this took place. And then they came out with the RCA jumped from 10-inch, believe it or not, they jumped from their 10-inch to the 16-inch in 48. Whereas Dumont, you just mentioned, Dumont went through the 10, and then Dumont started with a 7. They had a 7-inch set. Then they went to a 10, and then a 12-inch set. And then a 15-inch. And RCA never. RCA jumped from the... I could tell you all of them. I could tell you. Took them all apart and put them together and tore them apart, so many of them. And we got a whole collection of them. We got the earliest one we have, the earliest PD we have in our collection, 1939 Pilot, Dick, over.
HWW with a comment.
Okay, Howie recognized, Mel, you must have a museum. When you say we have in our collection, I begin to think it's you, your brother, and a warehouse to handle all these. I've got a whole series of questions, so I'm going to stand by for a second. Go ahead, Howie.
Was it Dumont that did something very unique? They used the coil for the magnet in the speaker, because they didn't have a permanent magnet, but they used the coil in the speaker, the electric magnet, where they used that as part of the filter choke. Was that on the Dumont radio, Mel?
That was on the Club 30. They had one big... they came out with this contraption. It was made for bars. In fact, you should see, they had one on a bar. It was down the corner where I lived in 1946, 47. And there'd be crowds standing outside, especially if you had a baseball game on. They called this thing the Club. This big Dumont that stood about, I don't know, 6 feet, 7 feet high. And weighed a ton and a half. And, they had a big speaker in there, and that was it. You were right. It had, that was the filter choke, part of the speaker, Howie, over.
Yeah, that's called an electrodynamic speaker. The filter choke was the magnet structure, and then it had the speaker coil and a humbucking coil, because there really was some AC on that magnetic field of that loudspeaker. It requires a humbucking coil so you wouldn't hear any hum in the background. Do you remember that, Mel?
Most definitely. They opened up, too. And what they did, they did some wild things and all. One of the companies later on, when they went to a PM speaker, they still have this idea, well, got to get around. How are we going to get around? For some reason, every power supply in those days had to have a choke. I don't know why, but that was the design to put in a filter choke. So what did they go ahead and do? Philco came up with that. GE came up with this idea. The ion trap, where most of the television sets now had gone to a magnet as the ion trap, GE came up and made the ion trap the choke. That was they had two coils wound on this contraption hanging on the neck of the tube, and that was a combination ion trap and filter choke, Dick, over.
Wow. And the ion trap, if there's any AC component there, you've got an AC component of the ion function. So the whole idea of the ion trap is that the stuff being boiled off from the cathode of the gun assembly of the cathode ray tube contained the electrons you wanted and the other things you didn't want. But the other things you didn't want had a different mass to them compared to electrons. So you literally, the gun assembly of the tube would aim the electrons from the cathode in the wrong direction so that they would hit an aperture and they would miss the hole. They would hit a screen and miss the hole. When you put the ion trap in there, you redeflected them into the right direction so that the electrons found the hole, but the ions were so much heavier, they didn't bend as fast, and therefore they didn't find the hole. That's how the ion trap worked. The little hole was one of the anodes inside the gun assembly, and the bending of that permanent magnet that had to be positioned just right on the neck would allow you to get full brightness on the screen. Sound about right, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, Yeah, roger. Yeah, a lot of times what would happen, in fact, sometimes, you know, the iron trap would vibration. Some of them would just start to spring on it, get the heat of the neck, would begin to make the spring loosen up enough that then, you know, if you had a, I'll tell you where it was the worst. We have an elevated subway here in Brighton, and the people, the poor people over there, they were plagued with every kind of problem. And that was one of their problems with the black and white set. It was that the iron trap would start to walk around from the vibration of the train. Later on, when the color TV started coming along, they had a new problem. The goddamn thing kept getting going out of conversion from the train, Dick, over.
Degaussing circuits. Why the older TVs had degaussing circuits?
Yeah, the degaussing, though, is a different problem, Howie. Any stray magnetic field built up anywhere in the set would change the convergence, and therefore the corners would develop funny colors and whatever, so you put the degaussing coil out front. Now, the whole reason for the ion trap is that the cathode, in order to give the cathode some life, you're putting all kinds of fancy strontium and stentorium or whatever, you're putting all kinds of fancy heavy metals into the cathode that's supposed to boil off at a cathode at a controlled rate in order to give you good cathode emission. That's the good news. The bad news is other things boiling off besides electrons, when they hit the phosphor, would poison the phosphor, and eventually the phosphor would give you less than normal illumination, and also would get funny patterns, funny ghosty patterns into the phosphor. So to get rid of those so-called ions, you had this ion trap assembly that I described earlier. Here's a question for you, Mel. Maybe my memory is wrong, but Dumont was selling sets. Dumont, I think, was located in New Jersey. They had some pretty nice designed TV sets. It is my belief that at one period of time, Dumont was also in control of Channel 5. I think Channel 5 was called the Dumont Network. I wonder if that's true, Mel. Go ahead.
W-A-D-T, Dumont Network.
Yeah, it was with Alan B. Dumont's network. Alan B. Dumont, I could say, 5WABC, Channel 5. And he used to, you know, do a little infomercial there showing how, you know, Tim Sittman is showing he started in his garage, the Dumont Lab. And, of course, Dumont, you know, got into a lot of things. You know, they started making instruments and everything. I mean, Dumont didn't restrict themselves to strictly television. That they did produce a heck of a good product as far as the TV set. And in fact, Dumont had the reputation of having the best tuner on the market at that time. They had a rotary tuner that was not compact. It was actually looked like a bunch of rotary inductors, three of them, in fact, on a porcelain shaft. It was built by Mallory strictly for Dumont. And a lot of hams, including me, we used them for, I made a 6-meter converter with it, I made a 2-meter and all, and oh, I don't remember, I used a number of different things. That was called the Mallory Infotuna. Like I say, they built them exclusively at that time for Dumont. So, yeah, Dumont was quite a company in its day. They got into a big way. With scopes, of course, they were, before Tektronix was around, they were supposedly the big scope producers, especially World War II, Dick, over.
And some of those early scopes used a simple neon tube for the actual sawtooth oscillator. And these scopes had a little bit of trouble getting up to 20 kilohertz to display the whole audio spectrum. And the scopes that could display video, they were really... Yeah, pretty snazzy oscilloscopes later on. But how about television programming? Howdy Doody, to my knowledge, was on Channel 4 on every single day. The Peanut Gallery, Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring, Howdy Doody, Mr. Bluster, Buffalo Bill, Buffalo Bob, it was Buffalo Bob and the Peanut Gallery. So that was Howdy Doody. I think Ernie Kovacs was also on Channel 4. I'm not sure. Could have been Channel 5. Channel 5 had a science fiction program. I can't think of the name of it now. It wasn't Tom Corbett's Space Cadets, but that was another program. What was the name of that science fiction program?
Video.
Yeah, Captain Video. You got it. Captain Video. And Dr. Pauly was the bad guy. boy, was he a bad guy. And they had this kind of a machine that could see through walls and keep track of people. Didn't Captain video that kind of a machine, Mel? Go ahead.
Including an atomic rifle. Dr. Pauly was his constantly battling Dr. Pauly. And in fact, they met the two of them. How did that happen? My father worked at that time for Warner on Avenue M here in Brooklyn. And they were introducing some of the, movie clips and things that they put in there. And they did some of the photographic work on Avenue M, that's now NBC Studios. That time it was Warner Brothers film, motion picture. And so he says, "Do you want to come down, with a big hero to me, with all his electronics and all his Captain video." So he took me down there that time. I was, 10? Yeah, I guess it was 10 years. Sure, about 1950. He took me down there, and I met Captain Video, and I was so surprised. I was afraid. I shook hands with Dr. Paul, and he laughed. He says, "Don't get upset." He says, "It's all make-believe. We're really good friends." And, oh, he was such a gentleman. I mean, I was so surprised. When I saw him, I recognized him right away, Dick, and I was like, petrified over.
And I bet you that took place 1949-1950. What was the question I had about Dr. Pauly? What was the name of that machine? The fly-by-die Librodider or something like that? The thing that could see through walls and keep track of people that Captain Video was trying to stop the bad guys? Ernie Kovacs, man, what a combination. Now, here's the thing. To my knowledge, Captain Video, I think it was live. Howdy Doody, I think it was live. I know that Ed Sullivan was live. I'm pretty sure that Gucci has a great big program. Oh, yeah. Milton Berle, that was all live. In fact, methods of transmitting movies on television were so poor, you had a definite fuzzy picture when it was anything but live. So I think 90-some-odd% of everything that we saw in television from, let's say, 1947 to 1955 or beyond, I think a very high percentage of it was a live performance. What do you think, Mel?
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to tell you something. This is K2KEY. I have a book here I just pulled out of the shelf called The Encyclopedia on Cathode Ray Oscilloscopes, and they use it by Ryder. Now, in here, there is a Dumont system. Dumont developed a system called, the Telestini system. And what it did, it was a big thing, stood about 8 feet tall. And the whole idea of what this would do is take the TV program, and it converted the TV program to 16-millimeter sound film. Let me see if I can find it in here. I just looked at it a few days ago. It's in here. I just happened to come across it one time. It was built by Dumont Labs, and that was the only way that you could make. They had no videotape. Of course, this is just 64 videotapes. And I feel it was just the electrostatic monoscope. It was a TV system that they built, actually, like I say. It copied the TV program onto film, Dick. Over.
I think that's called kinescope recording, and I believe they used a very slow phosphor to try to avoid the flicker. The huge, huge problem was the lack of standardization. Movie film, way back from the time Edison invented it, was somewhere around 16 frames per second. 16 frames per second, flash twice, 32 frames per second. Television is 30 frames per second. At first you'd say 32 frames per second for movie film and 30 frames per second for television. That sounds close. But that's going to give you 2 frames per second of flicker. It's a very annoying thing. So you either got to use some very elaborate 30 by 32, which really is what? 32 divided by 2 is 16. 15. A 15-16 ratio system. Every so often, after every 15 frames, you stick in an extra frame or something like that. You have to use some very elaborate system to do it directly, or I think you did it with a slow phosphor and recorded directly off the phosphor. In other words, a slow phosphor television picture to make sure it doesn't have flicker because of the difference. And if the phosphor didn't persist for at least half a second or more, you would get a flicker on the movie film taken off the cathode ray tube. And so therefore, almost all kinescope recordings are kind of fuzzy looking, and if there's any fast motion, you see blur. I wonder how close I'm accurate on this one, Mel. Go ahead. K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Very close. It was called the transcriber kinescope. I'm looking right at it now. Called the 5WP11 was the tube. It was using a Dumont Kite TA-150 called the kinescope transcriber or telecine system. And that's exactly, the picture tube was a special tube because of the persistence of the screen radiation sufficient short to prevent carryover. From one frame to the next, the metal backing of the screen, this tube was specially built, metal backing of the screen effectively doubles the radiant energy output in comparison with that obtained with no metal backing used. And this tube was specially fluorescent screen tube intended strictly for photographing of transcription television. And it was called the 5WP11. Boy, that's a rare one, I bet. And I'm looking at this thing, this Dumont monstrosity. God almighty, it must have stood 10 feet tall. It was all vertical. In other words, the picture tube in here was vertical, and then on top of it, the whole top section of it was a photographic camera, 16mm photographic camera system with the audio, a whole business here, Dick, over.
WA2CDL.
Andy recognized it. Boy, you got to be real careful when you make that recording because there's no going back. That recording that's done with the film has got to be accurate the first time, otherwise it's gone forever. And I think an awful lot of that was nitrate film, which doesn't store very well. Nitrate film decays and does all kinds of nasty things and eventually becomes a fire hazard. Andy, I wonder how much of all this you answer, remember. W2CDL, K2RIW.
Okay, good evening. W2CDL, listening in. Yeah, it's interesting. Not too much. My memory is not the way it used to be. But I want to ask you a question unrelated to what you're talking about. After you guys finish the discussion, I just want to bring up a topic I think you'd be interested in hearing about, relating to something you spoke about earlier. So, but I don't want to interrupt right now. And when you're done, I could come back in.
Andy, we're on such a big roll on nostalgia of electronics and nostalgia of early television and early television programming. This is never going to end. So let's break in right now, take your subject, and then we're going to go back to our favorite nostalgia. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay. I hope you don't mind, and hello to Mr. K2KEY. You mentioned earlier about 6 meters, and I wanted to bring up a little discussion about what if I recently saw an article in a CQ magazine dated June 2007, and they mentioned a mode of propagation, you probably heard of it, called whispering gallery, and they explain the 2006 worldwide band openings on 6 meters and how they achieved this goal. You know anything about it? Are you interested in hearing part of the article?
Go right ahead. When it comes to people standing in the right spot in the rotunda of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., you get this whispering gallery effect where a person can be, 50 or 100 feet away from you whispering very quietly and you hear everything he says. I've run into a similar phenomenon with a radar, a very large radar antenna, a harbor surveillance radar antenna. But go ahead and tell us about this whispering gallery on 6 meters, Andy. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this was done from out of Japan, some Japanese 6 meter operators, and I'm just kind of like reading it from the article here. We're delighted last May, June, and July, and this, of course, a year ago, 2006. by huge band openings, despite being at the bottom of the solar cycle, which was cycle 23. It was one of the biggest sporadic E openings since the 1970s, from Japan to the Atlantic coast of North America and Western Europe, over a distance of 6,800 miles. And they go on to ask, what were the mechanics behind these openings? Goes on to say that during the 1960s and 70s, intensive study and experiments were conducted by both E and F regions of the ionosphere, but there was no specific study on the ES, and the collected data were left behind in mothballs. Multi-hop sporadic E or ES propagation of 6 meters beyond the distance of a double hop, which is approximately 4,000 kilometers or 2,400 miles, is unrealistic because of heavy ionospheric attenuation and the F1 to FO ES ratio and the incidence angle to the ionosphere. The propagation mode is thought not to be a multi-hop mode, but a sporadic E-duct mode called whistling gallery, without intermediate ground reflections, which is also interesting. No intermediate ground reflections. This mode has no solar cycle dependence. It turns out what they did was they took their 6 meter beams and they actually changed the angle from 0 degree elevation, and they rotated up to about a 30 degree elevation, sort of manipulating the force of a higher elevation angle focusing towards the DX stations. And they say that while a flat antenna is best for working local stations, when you tilt the antenna towards the ionosphere, you get this interesting mode. I wonder if anybody here did that. Dick, back to you. Any comments?
I do remember around that time frame, in the 60s, a number of guys were running experiments where they were tilting their beam upward 10, 20, 30 degrees, occasionally even a little bit more, for at least two reasons. One, they thought it would help on meteor scatter. Some of them thought it would help on aurora reflection, the aurora curtain, and some of them thought that they would get better sporadic E propagation. I think the results from tilting the antenna in elevation are marginal for a couple of reasons. One, most of the antennas we're talking about had like a 40-degree vertical beam width, so you're going to get a slight enhancement with this vertical elevation some of the time, but most of the time, you're not going to get the improvement for normal terrestrial communication, which is what you do day in and day out. I guess there were very few in those days, enthusiastic individuals who had some kind of a motor control that could control the elevation. But most of the guys who really did elevate their beam would simply loosen up the U-bolt, so to speak, tilt it up to some elevation angle and tighten it back down and leave it there for a time. But I've never heard of huge performance improvements for doing that. If you're using a 5 or a 10 degree beamwidth antenna and you tilt it 20 or 30 degrees, boy, then you're really doing something. But if you've got a 40 degree beamwidth with a 5 element Yagi, I don't think 30 degrees of tilt is going to make a fantastic difference. A couple of dB, is it worth fighting for, considering what you give up most of the time? So I haven't heard great success with it, but maybe it's just my little close circle of friends. But yes, there are definitely times when guys were talking very long distances, like from New York to California, and you would think there had to be one or two bouncers in between onto the ground, and therefore you'd think the hams in between you'd be talking to. And either the hams weren't there and active at that time, or it really wasn't coming back down to ground. It really was the so-called whispering gallery, where it was bouncing between sporadic E clouds. Now, my experience with a sporadic E cloud is that when you get one, the signal you get reflected off of it is intense. In other words, the signal level gets 80 decibels stronger than normal. You take a signal that no way would you ever hear it unless the guy was running 50 kilowatts. And a sporadic E cloud comes along and a guy running 5 watts is pegging your S meter. That's what sporadic E is capable of doing. It's an extremely intense ionized cloud, moving kind of rapidly. They usually move 130 miles an hour to the northwest. So whoever you're talking to, you figure out where the cloud is located by, you know, looking at a map, and you can sort of predict where the opening will be next, because these sporadic e-clouds, once formed, they tend to stay quite a long period of time in duration, but they don't sit in one spot. They move very fast. That's some of my experience. Back to you, Andy.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
I did that experiment. I happen to have... Okay, let me get the mic here. This little button. I did the experiment, let's see, back... I guess it was back in the 60s with... on 6 meters. I took two Alliance. I had two Alliance rotated. And I made myself my own azimuth, you know, elevating system. I had a five-element Telerex beam, I remember. And I used to, you know, try tilting it and doing all kinds of things. And the only thing I found that sometimes, yeah, when I got it into maybe the vertical position because of that particular polarization at the time. But normally, I really never saw very much difference in, you know, just putting a slight tilt either way, say 15, 20, 25 degrees or so on the antenna there, Grover.
Yeah, that's what I sort of expected. But the article you're reading, Andy, does it imply that some fantastic improvement occurred because of the 30-degree up elevation of the boom of the Yagi? Go ahead.
That's what I'm reading now to see how they justify the antenna tilt to cause this occurrence to happen. Although the antenna itself is a high, it's a wide spaced long, at least a 10 meter length long boom length 6 meter beam. It's not a small antenna. I would gather the beam width of that antenna would be pretty narrow. Is that correct?
Yeah, Gunterhock, DL6WU, has this beautiful formula published in the German magazine where you know the number of wavelengths of the boom and he can tell you exactly what gain and beam width you're going to get. I had that programmed very nicely into my calculator, but that was one of the things that got lost when that particular calculator died because I dropped it on the concrete for the sixth time. I now treat my calculators with a lot more tender, loving care. And so... I wish I had the formula in my calculator right now. I could give you an exact answer, but every well-designed Yagi, there's an exact relationship that Gunter has discovered in number of wavelengths versus beam width. And of course, more wavelengths, more narrow beam width. And it is, as I remember, an almost, it's logarithmic in gain, but I think it's linear in beam width. I think a rough rule of thumb is every time you double the boom length in wavelengths, you half the beam width. Very rough rule of thumb. Back to you, Andy.
Okay. Yeah, very good. It goes on to say, it talks about the MUF, which, by the way, maybe you can explain and clarify what is the definition of maximum usable frequency? Because they mention here, and I've heard this term mentioned on 10 meters, you know, where is the MUF, and I know it moves around, and what determines it, and so on. But they say here that the MUF in the whispering gallery mode is twice the basic MUF of an equivalent multi-hop path between ground-based terminals. It also goes on to say the total calculated losses, inclusive of absorption, are relatively insensitive to terminal separation and are on the order of 125 to 138 dB from 25 megs to 45 megs. Goes on to say signals from satellites below the horizon have been explained by Chang, I guess 1970 orders, full-wave analysis of guided propagation in the ionosphere. The theoretical results indicate the MUF for F-layer whispering gallery propagation is approximately six times the incidence frequency.
as the ratio of wave frequency to vertical penetration frequency increases above 6, energy leaks and attenuation increases. And the MUF for E-layer whispering gallery is 14.9 times the vertical penetration frequency. That gets a little bit deep.
I'm not sure, but I'm going to be passing it over to Mel. I think the MUF is the frequency, the highest frequency, where if you aim the signal straight up, you'll get a significant echo. In reality, when you and I are doing any real DXing, we're aiming the signal out to the horizon, and it's hitting the ionosphere at a much more shallow grazing angle, and you get a much higher reflection. But I think that might be the definition of MUF. Correct me on that one, Mel. Go ahead.
I take the here, piled up the paces here. Let me take myself out a second here, so I can get the microphone cable. Maximum usable frequency. This term came along, you know, fairly late because we never heard about this back, as you say, in the good old days when we were discussing. So, if you want to actually call maximum, let me give you a simple answer to MUF. Let's put it this way. Most of our, you know, long distance, I think I'll try to explain it like I did at the club one time, and maybe it's the simplest way. Most long distance, you know, communication stems actually of the atmosphere known as the F layer. No, the F region. Yeah, the F region or F layer, right? That's where most of our long-distance communication capability comes. That's about the F layer, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Is it, what, 100 miles up, Dick, over?
That sounds about right from my memory, but I'm not sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, at that point, the ions and the electrons supposedly combined, recombined, I think, slower. Am I correct, over?
Without a doubt. As you go to a higher and higher altitude, where you've got lower and lower air pressure, lower and lower air pressure really means there's a greater and greater distance between individual air molecules. Air, by the way, each of the air molecules are always in motion. The amount of motion they're in is strictly a function of temperature. Everybody keeps forgetting, what is temperature? Temperature is average kinetic energy of the molecule. You double the temperature in absolute terms, degrees Kelvin, degrees Rankine, depending on whether you like centigrade or Fahrenheit. Those called centigrade and degrees Kelvin, Kelvin they call it. You double the Kelvin by going from 270, 290 Kelvin, which is considered room temperature, to 580 Kelvin. You have doubled the average velocity of the molecule, the average kinetic energy. Maybe it's 1/2 mv squared, maybe the velocity is not doubled, but you've doubled the kinetic energy of motion of the molecules. You and I would think air molecules are crashing into each other all the time. They absolutely do not. It's a completely elastic collision. I use the word collision in parentheses or in quotes. What happens when two air molecules come to close together to each other is because of electrostatic repulsion, they bounce off each other without physical contact. Air molecules almost never touch each other. It is bouncing around like a bunch of ping pong balls. But the ping pong balls really touch each other. Air molecules do not touch. They get close because of equal charge and electrostatic repulsion. They get repelled from each other. So you go up high enough in altitude where the air molecules are low enough in temperature and far enough spaced apart, you now have a very long mean free path. Mean free path means you take the average molecule at that temperature, he's moving along, how far does he have to go before he encounters another air molecule? And if that mean free path is a very long distance because of thin air, low pressure, and low temperature, then you get very little probability of recombination. Ions mean cosmic rays, or no, it's more likely ultraviolet rays. Ultraviolet rays coming from the sun hit the upper ionosphere area, hit the air there, disassociate. In other words, the energy of the ultraviolet rays is strong enough to take a certain number of those electrons and rip them away from the nucleus of that air molecule. So now you have a charged plasma. Turns out the ionosphere is a charged plasma. It's got disassociated protons, which are the nucleus of the air molecule, and these free-floating electrons. And so when the air molecule experiences, on average, the mean free path, encounters another air molecule, if that air molecule he encounters happens to be negatively charged because it's got an excess electron, and this one is positively charged because he's got a dearth of electrons, now that encounter is very different. All of a sudden, the excess electron hops from one to the other, and all of a sudden you've got two things that used to be ionized. They're no longer ionized. They've been deionized. So deionization takes place much more slowly at higher altitudes. That's why you have a much higher probability of an ionosphere. And the ionosphere is strongest during the daytime when the sunshine is hitting the ionosphere. And from that experience, you would say, gee, 80 meters should be gangbusters at noontime. Well, the ionosphere is doing its thing, without a doubt. However, the daytime ultraviolet rays from the sun go all the way down to the D layer, create a whole lot of much lower altitude, create such a dense ionization in the D layer that it becomes absorptive. So you're getting great reflections at a much higher altitude on 80 meters at high noon, but the dawn signal never gets there because of D layer absorption. This is some of my understanding of the subject. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Very correct, almost. This is K2KEY. Okay. What Dick's trying to say, I'll try to put it into some of the words, basically. What I tried that time to explain, because it seems like this MUF is a little bit of a mystery and a little complicated. As we were saying, at about 100-mile height, the ions and the electrons recombine more slowly. So the effects of the sun develop more slowly, actually. So what happens at this point, at the ability, the region holds the ability to reflect the waves back to Earth well into the night. And the maximum usable frequency, the MUF, for the F layer, for instance, the east-west, let's say the east-west path, thus peaks somewhere around, I think around afternoon. I believe that's approximately when the, as called the east-west path. And the minimum occurs after midnight. So this is basically how we refer to the MUF. So it depends, again, on the frequency. Now, I can go a little further with it, but you want to say something so far, Dick? In other words, what I just, did I more or less make it as straightforward as possible? Or?
Yeah, I'm a little fuzzy on this one because I'm more of a VHF, UHF person than I'm an HF person. But when high noon ultraviolet rays strike the upper layers of the atmosphere, like the F1, F2 layer, they create some pretty intense ionization. As you go to more and more intense ionization, a higher and higher frequency will be reflected. You could say that the higher the frequency, the more it has penetration capability. Very similar to what happens with X-rays. If you tried to focus X-rays with a magnifying glass, you'd be very disappointed. The X-rays just pour right through the glass and say, I didn't even see that glass. So you get a similar phenomenon going on with radio signals. As you go to higher and higher frequency of radios, like VHF and UHF frequencies, as far as they're concerned, that ionosphere is not even there. They just go roaring right through. They didn't see a thing. It's not until you get to the lower frequencies where you get a reflection. So maximum usable frequency, they're trying to tell you for this state of ionization at this altitude today, now, for this particular path, this is the highest frequency when you will get significant reflection of the ionosphere. I use the word reflection in quotes. It is not a pure reflection. It's an ionospheric absorption and re-radiation phenomenon. It looks like reflection. It's more complicated than that. We won't go there right now. But so there is a frequency. When you go higher than that, you ain't going to get significant ionospheric reflection, and you're going to think the band is dead. That's sort of my understanding. And this is not my strong point. Back to you, Mel.
Just take to KEY. Okay, basically you're explaining it, but like you say, I see you're not an HF fan. All right. What Dick is basically saying, that for instance, we will get what we call a vertical incidence, critical frequency. That is what is known as the MUF. So, for instance, for a local sky wave communication, the optimum working frequency and determination of the MUF for that 2 points at a given time. In other words, if you're making a contact, you want to make a contact between two places, you will know what is the critical frequency for that particular time of day. And let me take this off the top of my head. I'll remember something about, I believe, a little time since I did this. But okay, I'll give you, for instance, like the critical frequency between on 80 meters, I can remember by band, about 80 meters, you know, around 3 or 4 megahertz, is the E layer during the daytime. And frequency safe up to about 12 megahertz or so, like up to the, a little past the 40 meter band, up to around the 30 meter band. That's called, usually is the F2 layer during the daytime. So the lowest figures that you would have for nighttime conditions, let me make this in the right word, the lowest figures that you would get for nighttime conditions is the lowest of the, in other words, we're right now in the solar minimum right now. So this will be the lower figures, so the MUF will be actually, these critical frequencies will be lower. So, let me see, I guess I'm getting a little confusing here. So really speaking, I guess let me simplify MUF then. MUF is the maximum usable frequency, is actually defined as communication between two specific points on the Earth's surface for the conditions existing at the time. That includes minimum elevation angle, that the station can launch the signal at that frequency. That's what it is. At the same time, for the same conditions, the MUF from either of these 2 points to a third point may be different. In other words, just because you are talking to California from here doesn't mean that the guy in Australia is going to hear you, but he does hear the California station. This is basically what they're referring to. I hope I made that simple enough, Dick. Over.
Yeah, wound into all of this is the so-called skip zone. If I launch a signal on, I'm going to pick a number, 40 meters, and if it's a reasonably good condition, I'm not sure if this is true, but in my example, assume it's a pretty good condition off the ionosphere for you and I to talk from the Long Island area to your buddy in Chicago. And assume that Chicago is a single hop off of the F layer. So single hop off the F layer, I'm not sure if this is accurate, but in my example, if that gets between here and Chicago, that signal is taking off from my antenna, maybe 10 degrees above the horizon, glancing off the ionosphere with about a 10 degree bounce angle, and then coming down in Chicago. And if I want to talk to my buddy in Philadelphia, a hell of a lot closer, he's beyond my ground wave communication, so I can't talk to him directly. I can only get to him by way of reflecting the signal off the ionosphere. The only way I can get a bounce into Philadelphia is for the signal to take off from my antenna, not 10 degrees above the horizon, but maybe 40 degrees above the horizon. Well, when you hit the ionosphere at a 40-degree angle instead of a 10-degree angle, you're asking the ionosphere to create a much bigger bend to get that signal back down to Earth. And if the MUF is not high enough, if the maximum usable frequency is not supporting it, the guy in Philadelphia ain't going to hear a thing. So you get skip zones. And the thing that's hard to understand at first is, hey, I'm talking to a guy in Chicago, almost 1,000 miles away. He's gangbusters. He's pegging the needle on my signal strength meter on my receiver. And my buddy running a kilowatt in Philadelphia ain't there.